Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
But it also taught me that so much of the literature I love, so people like Coleridge and Wordsworth and Hardy, to a lesser extent Dickens, and especially the non-fiction of Virginia Woolf, it took me a while to work out that the things that they were really, or the things that they did that I really admired, like Thomas Hardy in particular, writes about landscape in just sort of a breathtaking way. And his ability to notice things. I think W.H. Auden said that Hardy had a sort of hawk vision, that he was able to tune in on tiny parts of the landscape and just sort of write about them in these miraculous ways. And I started to see that there was a connection between that kind of literature, the kind of literature that forced us to look again at the world around us that we were missing, and running, which is something that forces me to, you know, zone out of what it is that I've become obsessed with on any given day, and it gets me outside to look at things.
What's the man running away from? I'm running from my asthma, emails, responsibilities, middle age, my chair, my chores. I'm on the run from my genetic inheritance too. The amusing words of British writer, teacher and runner Vibber Cregan-Reid from his new book, Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human, published by Ebury Press. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to explore the sweaty, challenging and glorious world of running with Vibber Cregan-Reid and ask, are we becoming too static? In Footnotes, Vibber Cregan-Reid argues, we don't just see with our eyes, but with our whole bodies. Vibber goes on to state, running has taught me that our perceptions occur in a stream or path. We do not take in a single scene all at once, we move through it. So, what is running? Can it transform us? And can running make you smarter, or at least better at your job?
I'm Vibber Cregan-Reid. I've recently published a book called Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human. I'm a lecturer in 19th century literature at the University of Kent in England. The book is a wide-ranging study of what running means to us, what happens when we do it, and all the reasons that we might want to do it. And the reason that I wrote it was because I'm a very passionate runner. I'm not necessarily a very talented runner, but I'm a very passionate runner. It's something that I really, really love doing. And I just felt that there was a lot more going on when I did it than me just getting a bit fitter. So I wrote a book and I found out all kinds of magical things about this very simple and really natural form of exercise.
Really well done on the book, Vibber. I have to say it's a hugely curious read. It really made me think about my built environment and the natural world around.
Thank
and
you.
How I go about my day. Because you ask some unbelievably interesting questions and very demanding questions, I might add, of yourself and of the reader as you progress through the book. So hats off to you on that front. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. Is running more than running, do you think?
Well, it is. I think for the people that do it, I think most of them would find it very easy to answer that question. They would just say, yes, of course it is. But I think so lots of people do run, about 2 million people run in the UK. But lots and lots of people don't run, and they see runners and, you know, it looks like a terrible thing, and they think that it's bad for your knees or that it gives you injuries, and it just looks like a very uncomfortable way of exercising. And it also looks boring. It also looks like there is nothing to do while you're doing this kind of exercise. So I think So the people that do it, they already know that running is more than running. And the people that don't, maybe they don't. And I think when you look at running from the outside, it looks like it's something that is useful to us, that it's done not for itself, but for another reason. It's done because people want to lose weight. People think that people run because they want to get fitter or they want to live longer. So it can be seen as this really quite mechanistic thing, as merely just a means to an end, to control your weight or to maintain fitness. Whereas what I discovered in the writing of the book was, while those two things are certainly true, there are hundreds of things about running that our body, you know, is craving for and rewards us for in ways that runners might suspect but have never really had the opportunity to confirm. So, yeah, it's a lot more than becoming fit. It's a lot more than just taking in some exercise. And it's also something more than just a competitive sport. It can be something much bigger and greater than just a race.
Do you think it could be argued that running is a means to freedom, or something close to freedom?
It's a really, really difficult question, and I think it would take a philosopher or a thinker much more talented than me to be able to answer it. But one of the reasons that I wrote the book was because I did have this sense of freedom. It enhanced my feelings of freedom by being able to run. So, as I said before, I'm not a very fast runner, but I can usually run quite long distances. And there are things that happen in your brain. You get to know footpaths, and you get to be able to remember. There's a sort of visual memory of these huge spaces, these huge runs that you can do, where you're able to hold all of this space in your head, and it's almost like the world becomes a bigger place once you're free to move in it. But also, I think that it goes back to the sort of previous thing I was saying about the idea that we need to use running for something. And I think so much of our lives are about doing things for another reason rather than for themselves. And I think it's really, really important that we occasionally put everything down and we do something that we just really, really enjoy, whether that's cycling or whether it's yoga, any sort of physical pursuit that's done for the pleasure in and of itself will give us time away from our jobs, from our commitments, and will give us a sense of freedom, I think, from having all our time accounted for. So, yeah, I think freedom is a really big aspect.
You write in your introductions that running has made your life more sustainable, and it's given you more than you ever asked of it.
Yeah.
Can you talk me through that?
It's made my life sustainable. I think the more that I've done it, when I've been through periods of my life when I run a lot, because I go through periods where I run more than at other times. It makes my life sustainable because it gives me, one thing, it de-stresses me, it calms me down. So it makes my life sustainable because it means I can always get away from the things that are piling up on me. So if I have, hundreds of emails that I need to reply to, all I need is 30 or 60 minutes out on the tramp, as it were, and I will come back feeling mentally refreshed and more able to deal with the things that both matter and don't matter.
Why do you think it is, Viber, that so many people think that they either don't have the body to be a good runner, or they don't have the stamina or the fitness to be able to become either a really good runner or even start out running, that they talk themselves out of it before they even engage?
Well, I think, one of the things I talk about in the book is that if we were training to be sedentary workers, to not do anything, the amount of hours that we put in to our training every day would make us all sort of Olympians. So what happens is, once we go to school when we're very young, we have a kind of kinetic and almost uncontainable energy, and then over our 10, 12, 15 years of schooling, we are taught to sit still. We're basically in training for sedentary work, sedentary leisure, and a sedentary life. Now, if you've spent your time since the age of five to sit around and do nothing, and then at the age of 35 you suddenly jump up off the sofa and take your body running down the street, it's going to be really, really unhappy about the decision that you've made, and it's going to injure. You are going to get injured. So I think when lots of people start any kind of fitness regime, but running is a particularly good one, they have unreasonably high expectations of their abilities, that we are attentive to our activity, but we're not really attentive to our inactivity. You know, it's very easy for us to remember that we did 30-minute exercise yesterday, we're going to do 45 minutes today, but nobody knows how much time they spent sitting down yesterday. You know, they might be able to make a guess, but I'd be surprised if people were correct within, you know, 2 or 3 hours. Whereas with exercise, you can probably do it to a few minutes. So the main thing I would say to a new runner is to lower your expectations, because almost everybody that quits in the first couple of weeks quits because they did too much. I've never, ever heard of anybody that gave up in the first few weeks of running because they did too little. Ever. I've never heard of that. So the body will respond. The body responds in really interesting ways to any sort of new exercise. So we have several kinds of tissue. We have osseous tissue, like our, you know, hard tissues, like our bones. We have different kinds of soft tissue. We have muscles, and we have tendons and ligaments. Now, your heart is a muscle, and our muscles respond really, really quickly to new forces or new demands that are put on them. So any new runner that goes out and runs for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, the next day maybe their quads might be, their leg muscles might be a little bit sore, but within a few days they're going to notice that the 2 or 3 minutes, the minutes running that they did is suddenly a lot easier, because the muscles respond really, really quickly. And the respiratory system is basically muscular, so we actually get fitter very, very quickly. But the body isn't always in sync with itself, and the harder soft tissues, like tendons and ligaments, they can take about 2 weeks to respond to just the first bit of exercise that you do. And your osseous tissue, your bones, can take about 4 weeks to respond to your first run. So what happens is, usually by the end of a month, people's fitness and stamina have increased dramatically, but their bones are, you know, basically the same as on day one. So the body is sort of, it's like a minefield, where we've instilled too much sedentary behaviour into it, which we take for granted, and then once we take it out on the run, it really does struggle. So it needs time and care and attention.
Fibar, you write, a good runner basically needs a Paleolithic body, one that is used to regular movements, has a strong core, excellent glutes, and a well-developed intrinsic and extrinsic muscles in the feet and the lower legs. I thought that was very interesting. But again, a lot of people would argue that, you know, I maybe have a strong core, but I've got flat feet, let's say, or I may have excellent glutes, but I'm just not cut out for it.
Well, there's lots of evolutionary evidence that suggests that many features of our body have specifically evolved for running, not for walking. So, for example, our Achilles tendon. Everyone knows the Achilles tendon. It's the tendon that runs on the back of the leg, just above the ankle. Most other primates don't have an Achilles tendon. You don't need an Achilles tendon to be able to walk. You only need it to be able to run. But we have features. I went to see a paleoanthropologist, and he said we have features in our bodies from the tips of our toes all the way to the tops of our heads that specifically have evolved us specifically for running. So it means that, you know, just like primates can climb trees, or just like fish swim, you know, we are designed to run. Now, what happens is that So there's the Paleolithic, and then there's, more recently, there's the new geological era is about to be declared the Anthropocene, and the Anthropocene is basically the modern world where human endeavour has left an indelible mark on the planet. It's a whole big debate. But the differences in the bodies is that what we have now is we have billions of us who do very, very different kinds of work. So when we were at grassland tribes, or you know, when we were hunter-gathering tribes, we would move something in the region of 5 to 9 miles every single day. And research was published just recently, where it said people between the ages of 40 and 60, I think it was 40% of people between the ages of 40 and 60, walked in less than 10 minutes per month.
That is shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, well, if you think that our bodies are designed to walk 5 to 9 miles a day, you know, 9 miles is about 2.5 hours walking. So we should be walking for about, say, 2 to 2.5 hours a day, and we're walking for, on average, about 10 to 15 seconds.
And when you think what that does to the brain, like forget about the body alone, what that does to your sense of creativity and your curiosity in the world and all over the world, apart from psychological well-being, apart from mojo.
Absolutely. You know, we only have brains because we move. You know, plants don't have brains. They don't need them. They don't need a nervous system because they don't move. So we only have brains because we move. And most of us are becoming static. Most of us are not using our brains for what they were designed to be used for. Our bodies really crave movement, and they also crave the outdoors. And they reward us in these very subtle but incredibly sophisticated ways for these efforts. So as a hunter-gathering, as a hunter-gatherer in the Paleolithic, you know, if you went out on an endurance hunt, an endurance hunt is basically, it's a kind of hunting where early humans used all their best advantages to track and kill animals. So the main advantages we have are running, but we're actually not very good runners. If you look at other mammals, we're actually terrible. You know, I live in London and we have lots of squirrels around, and you know, I can't even outrun a squirrel. You know, and these tiny little things. So over short distances, we are just awful runners. But what we're really, really good at is long distance running. So we have lots of bits of our body that specifically are designed for this long distance running. So a mammal, a four-legged, you know, a quadruped, mammal has approximately 70% of their body exposed to the sun on a hot day. Because we're bipedal, because we're on 2 feet, only about 40% of our body is exposed to the sun on a hot day. So immediately we have a heat advantage. But most other mammals don't sweat for the same reasons that we do. In fact, we're the only mammal that does sweat for the reason that we do, which is because sweating is an incredibly efficient way of losing heat. So not only is less of our body exposed to the sun, but we also have this incredibly efficient technology for the dumping the heat that we take on when we're running on a hot sunny day. So if you go running after an antelope, you know, the antelope is going to look back at you disdainfully as it leaps off, you know, covering hundreds of yards in a few seconds. But as we plod along for those 100 yards, we're able to keep our body temperature down, whereas the antelopes will eventually spike, and they'll get to the point of, after several miles, we'll get to the point of heat exhaustion, and we'll still be able to keep going. The mammal will have, you know, collapsed. So in the paleo, we're adapted to do this kind of hunting, but our bodies are also wired to reward us precisely for this kind of hunting. So one of the things that runners often speak about is the runner's high. The runner's high is this sort of euphoric release of substances in the blood and in the brain that means that our veins and capillaries dilate, so our blood can flow easier around the body. It's also pain-killing, so if your knees are beginning to hurt at all, you know, from your run, it means that you can take less notice of the pain. This seems to me to be a mechanism, an evolutionary biological mechanism that's evolved to reward people that are able to get food. I mean, there's also the thing about intelligence as well, that the idea that new brain cells are made on very long runs.
Yeah, well, what's clear is that I think anyway, for most people, the best ideas come in motion. And whether that's swimming, cycling, running, walking, whatever it is, dancing, that there is a correlation between movement and getting into the flow and allowing your, giving your mind that space where the ideas can come or where you can problem solve. Like, I know if any ideas I get them on the bike or I get them when I'm walking.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know what I mean? And if I have a problem, I get out and walk and I can figure it out. I don't figure it out by being stationary.
No. And I think that's very common. When we do sort of any kind of aerobic exercise, one of the things that happens, so this would apply to cycling as well, but when we do any sustained aerobic exercise, so I'd say fast hill walking would be the only kind of walking that would do this. There's a part of our brain, it's sort of a horseshoe that sits at the back of our head called the hippocampus. And what it does is it does memory indexing and it does spatial awareness. So there was tests done on, you know, London black cabbies years ago, and they were found to have these sort of bulging hippocampuses because they had to acquire all of this knowledge that now is less necessary because we all have maps on our phones. So the hippocampus during any sustained aerobic exercise, new brain cells are pinged into the hippocampus. It's a process called hippocampal neurogenesis, and what they do is they don't make you smarter, but what they do is they make you ready to learn something. But there's also the fact is that, you know, there's a common saying about we only ever use 10% of our brains. And you can draw and this is true, but you can draw an analogy between brain activity and bodily activity. I mean, I don't know about you, Susan, but, you know, how many muscles are you using at the moment? I think I'm using about 5 or 10% of mine. You can't use 100% of your muscles all at once. It doesn't work. I mean, maybe if you're having an electric shock or something, but other than that, you can't. The system doesn't function in that way. So resources in the brain are basically competitive. So if you drain one part of the brain, so say if you're having a really really bad day, you're really struggling with self-esteem, and there's a dinosaur bit of our brain buried at the top of our spine, at the backs of our heads, and that's pumping stress. It's telling you that you're no good, nobody likes you, nobody thinks your work is any good. If you literally get out of your chair and go for a walk, go for a swim, go and cycle, what you're doing is you're draining the energy from the part of your brain that's making you feel stressed. And it's being, you know, if you're doing sort of any sort of complex motor activity like running or cycling or ballet, anything, it means that it's more difficult for you to feel stressed because you're doing something else at the same time. It's a terrific system. And never mind the fact as well that just because while you're doing the exercise itself, you're actually releasing lots of de-stressing neurotransmitters like, you know, dopamine and serotonin. So it's just a win-win-win-win, really, is to get out of your chair and do something, shake up your brain chemistry and look at things a little bit differently, because your brain is, you know, your brain is pumping blood in different ways than it would be if you're sitting in a chair.
You're a big fan of running in forests, and I know you write throughout footnotes, you visit a range of different locations where you're running all around, and you write beautifully about the natural world and your mind stills as you approach different green vistas, and it's really, really beautiful. But I'm just wondering, why do you think we've got so far away from nature?
Well, you get a lot more from nature. So lots of the, I mean, I go to a gym just like everyone else does, but as well, but The gym is really tricky. It's really odd. The gym is the junk food of exercise. You know, with the burger, the flour is processed in the bun. Sugar is added. The sugar has been processed, and then sugar is added. And then with the meat, you know, the chewing of the meat has already been ground up. So we've outsourced the chewing of the burger to some factory on the outskirts of town. And by the time we get to eat it, lots of the good stuff has gone. What's left is sort of fat and sugar and carbohydrates, but lots of the nutrients have been chucked out of it. And the gym is exactly the same. So don't get me wrong, I'm not all down on the gym, but the gym is the junk food of exercise, because lots of the things that we get from our exercise, especially by exercising in green spaces or forest spaces or just outdoors, lots of things we get, we don't get them if we exercise in a gym. So we get the benefits just of the exercise, but not from the green spaces. And the green spaces are incredibly potent, incredibly potent.
You write somewhere, I think, that forests have more to offer us than we can understand. And I know one of the joys about being in a forest is that you have to really go into the present moment, the here and now, because you have to watch where you're putting your foot. There's different lights and shades, different textures underfoot. So it brings you into that very clear here and now, doesn't it?
It really, really does. I mean, they're very, very special places. I would say that maybe 5,000 BC, Ireland would have been completely covered in trees. The forest cover would have been like 99.95%. It certainly was in mainland UK. Now, at the height of the Industrial Revolution in the UK, forest cover went from this sort of 99.9% down to 4%. And now we're just sort of crawling back. And the forest cover rate is now about 7%. But, you know, forest cover in Japan is two-thirds. Two-thirds of the country is covered in trees still. So we've stripped these things out of our lives, and they've now become a novelty, whereas what they were, several thousand years ago, forests were our home. It's where we lived. So you get lots of benefits from being in nature, in natural environments, you know, whether that's by the seashore or in your local park. But there are additional benefits to being in forest environments as well. There's and the reason that I said that they offer is more than we understand is because only in the last sort of few years has research started to come out of Japan that it's just absolutely miraculous what forest time can do. So in Japan, they call it shirinyoku, which translates roughly as forest bathing. And all forest bathing is going to a forest place, going to a woody place, and just spending time there. Forest bathing would be like spending a day or two in a wooded environment. And it's because there are lots of volatile compounds. We all know what forests smell like. And there are lots of volatile compounds are released by trees. So just like we have an immune system, plants also have an immune system as well to protect them against whatever has been attacking them. So they've evolved. Plants have evolved just like we have. So the reason that garlic smells, the reason that onion smells, these are protective mechanisms of these plants to stop themselves from being eaten. You know, it's not a great defense mechanism, but whatever bug it was that was attacking garlic, the kind of garlic that really stank was the kind of garlic that continued to exist. So these volatile compounds are found in much higher concentrations in forests, and research in Japan basically showed that it was like a miracle cure. So people with, which did they test first? They tested high blood pressure. So people that had high blood pressure, after spending time in a forested environment, I think with one of the tests it was like about 2 days, they found that the trial subject's blood pressure dropped for up to 30 days after they'd left the forest. And a trial was done much more recently, just last year, where they actually mixed up people that had high blood pressure and low blood pressure. So if you think that if you have high blood pressure, you go to a hotel deep in the forest somewhere, and your blood pressure gets lowered as a result, which is a huge benefit. But then you think, oh, so does that mean it's a risk? If you've got low blood pressure and you go to a forest and it lowers your blood pressure even more, it could be fatal. But it's absolutely incredible. It turns out that if you've got low blood pressure or high blood pressure, time in a forest environment will make your condition, will improve your condition. So it raises the blood pressure of people with low blood pressure and lowers the blood pressure of people that have too high. It's incredible.
Here I am, floating in emerald sea. Keep me dancing, keep me as still as can be. And I try to keep the balance right, and I try, but it feels like wasted time.
Welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British writer, teacher and runner Vibra Cregan-Reid, author of Footnotes, How Running Makes Us Human, published by Ebury Press, where Vibra writes, "There is a history to how places feel. With refined senses, we can read these histories. Lifetimes may come and go, and the architecture of cities may rise and fall. But there are aspects to places we visit or inhabit that outlive us and are passed forward to coming generations, or even for a thousand years." I asked Vibra about his visit to the Spalding National Running Centre at Harvard Medical School and the work of Professor Irene Davis, who believes only neurological conditions tend to be the deal breakers when it comes to running, that you can run with flat feet and that it's possible to run injury-free. I asked Vibra, what did he make of it all?
Runners get injured a lot, and I get injured, I'd say, even more than average runners do. But I now firmly believe that when we go out for a run, we don't really get injured very much. We actually pick up our injuries when we're playing on the PlayStation, as I often do. But we actually pick up our injuries during our sedentary life. That's because that's what we're training our bodies to do, is to do nothing.
So like sitting on the couch or something like that?
Yeah,
or,
I think we all have couch injuries. Mm. We don't have running or cycling injuries. We have sitting on your arse injuries. Yeah. But I think that's where we pick up our injuries. So up to 79% of runners, the statistics vary slightly, but up to 79% of runners report an injury that prevented them from running at least once a year. So this is a staggering, figure. So, yeah, people at the Spalding National Running Centre, yeah, they talked about the ideas that that they thought actually it was they only saw very, very few people that could not run. So flat feet are really, well, I think flat feet are really interesting. So my next book, the book I'm writing at the moment, is about what modern life has been doing, is doing and has been doing for the last few hundred years to our bodies. And one of the things is flat feet. So approximately 50% of adult Americans have flat feet. And this is what's known as a mismatch disease. And what a mismatch disease is, it's when our genetic tendencies meet a particular environment. So if in a Paleolithic human, an early human, had a high genetic a tendency towards type 2 diabetes, for example, it's very unlikely that an early human would have found an environment in which that genetic tendency could express itself. So even though there might have been loads of early humans that had even more potential for type 2 diabetes than we have today, there just wasn't an environment to meet it. You know, you can't go out onto the veldt and find piles of donuts. They're just not there. So what scientists think is that these mismatch diseases are really about a mismatch between the designs and intentions of our bodies and the environment that they find themselves in. In hunter-gathering tribes, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but I would say that in hunter-gathering tribes, flat-footedness is found in less than 1% of the population. And yet now it's incredibly common. So flat-footedness is really to do with not some, I was going to say we're not born with flat feet, but actually all of us are born. All of us are born with flat feet, and then the arch develops as through our childhood. But the shoes, the kinds of shoes we wear, and the kinds of life that we lead, what's happened with is that about 40 to 30,000 years ago, our species started to wear shoes. So for the vast majority of our time on the planet, which is something in the region of 2 to 2.8 million years, we've not used shoes, but we've started to wear them in the last 30 to 40,000 years, and now almost everybody wears them. And what they do is they outsource some of the muscular work that is done by the foot to, you know, a relatively tough piece of rubber. And Irene Davis uses a wonderful analogy. So if you have a supportive shoe that has a kind of good arch in it that stops your arch from collapsing when you walk or when you run, your arch is designed to collapse. It's designed to load itself with pressure that it can then give back to you when you toe off, either walking or running. So if you have a solid support in your shoe, you're outsourcing some of the muscular work of your foot to the shoe. And our bodies are really, really good at maintaining what it is that they both need and don't need. So I talked earlier about injury risks to early runners. And these are things like, you know, pulling a tendon, tearing a muscle, or getting a microfracture in your bones. So your body basically tries to map itself to what you're requiring from it. So there are two laws. There's Wolf's law, which says that if you do nothing, so if you go into space, if you don't do any exercise and you're in space, your bones will start to destroy themselves, which is a natural process because the body doesn't want to waste calorific expenditure on dense bones when you're in space. So the body starts tearing away the bone density. And there's a law for the muscles as well, which is Davis's law, which is basically the use it or lose it law. And if we sit down all day, we are losing it. So we're not using the muscles in our legs, in our bums or in our feet. And so those muscles become thinner and thinner and thinner. And this is especially so for the feet. So there are 27 intrinsic muscles that just are inside our feet. And if we are outsourcing that muscular work to a shoe, the muscles atrophy, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. So Irene Davis, Professor Irene Davis, she uses this great analogy of wearing a supportive shoe is like walking around in a neck brace, you know, and then wearing a neck brace for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and months and months and months because you're trying to protect your neck muscles. When in fact what you're doing is you're making your neck muscles really, really weak because you're outsourcing their ability to their supportive role to this neck brace. So running barefoot, when I first came across it, I thought it was completely nuts. But what it does is it tries to restore some of this muscle and bone mass to the foot. And many barefoot runners report the fact that even though they began with flat feet, barefoot running actually gave them an arch back.
Fiber, you went to the University of Michigan and you met with two environmental psychologists, I think. It was a Dr. Avik Basu and Jason Duval. And they've really interesting ideas on why people get so bored when they're running. And they talk a lot about, you know, that I suppose how we've evolved, that our ability to not concentrate or discipline ourselves to concentrate is becoming a really grave problem, and it could be an evolutionary threat.
Yeah, I mean, so I went to the University of Michigan to meet these guys who work in a field called environmental psychology. And as disciplines go, as academic disciplines go, it's not a particularly old one. It's really quite new. It's only been around for a few decades. And the work that they do is they're assessing the impact that certain environments have on certain psychological tasks, but mainly on sort of mental health and well-being. And their work they do is absolutely fascinating. So they do all sorts of things, like they test the recovery rates of hospital patients who had a view of the garden or had a plant in their room, and they found basically nature always wins. Access to nature always wins in any experiment they do. It turns out that being in a natural environment improves it in some way. So the people that had a view of a natural space from their hospital beds recovered quicker. There's also a fascinating experiment done at the University of Michigan by Avik and Jason's supervisors, where they were testing our abilities to mentally restore. So we all know that feeling when we've, you know, read 80 or 100 pages of a book and we just feel sort of mentally tired, or we get in from work and we know we've not been working physically hard, but we feel just exhausted and not able to concentrate. Well, our abilities to concentrate are, it's a little bit like a muscle. So our abilities to concentrate can't be made stronger, but other than that, it's like a muscle. So if you do a small bit of work with a muscle, like, I don't know, lifting a pint of Guinness, so the first 50 or 100 or 200 times that you did that, you'd think, oh, this is quite easy, yep. But then after, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, half an hour, even though it's an easy task, it would start to get more difficult and the muscle would get tired. And the only way to restore that muscle is to rest it. And this is one thing that we're really, really not very good at as a species in modern life, is knowing how to rest our attentional capacity. And it's no surprise that the single best way to restore our abilities to concentrate is to spend some time in a green space, or even just the simulacra of a green space, so even looking at a nature movie or something. Yeah, it's a completely, completely fascinating field. But I've never got round to it, but I want to write a piece about why, you know, we're evolving to become... we're getting taller, you know, evolution is supposed to improve things, but we're not actually getting any smarter. There was a psychological revolution about 40,000 years ago when, you know, as a species, Homo sapiens did suddenly get smarter. But from then on, you know, we've stayed pretty much static. And another one of the things that's not changed is our abilities to concentrate have not changed. We all get tired when we concentrate for long periods. But if you think about it, it's an evolutionary safety mechanism. If you were easily fascinated, easily enthralled in a particular problem, it makes it much easier for you to be predated upon by a panther or a leopard or something, because you're not being aware of your environment, and also you're not able to engage socially to help get the problem solved by using a group of people. So it's a nice evolutionary mechanism that our brains are required to tune out at regular intervals throughout the day in order for us to keep functioning properly. And if they don't get to tune out, we just burn out.
You sprinkled some beautiful literary references throughout the book. We get Tolstoy, get Hardy, we get lovely passages from Coleridge, Wordsworth and Virginia Woolf. We also get some segments from Walden, the book Walden. And I thought that really added value to the overall reading experience. And it got me thinking about these extraordinary writers and extraordinary active people and all the lessons that they've learned. So I'm just wondering, to finish things up, what has running taught you?
Oh gosh, well I think running is still teaching me. You remember in the 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s when people got married and people would tie loads of tins to the car as it drove away? When I go out running, that's what it feels like. When I come back, it feels like I'm dragging a load of ideas in my wake. So I think every time I do go running, it continues to teach me something about it. And it helps me to connect things up as well in ways that I can't in my normal everyday life. But it also taught me that so much of the literature I love, so people like Coleridge and Wordsworth and Hardy, to a lesser extent Dickens, and especially the nonfiction of Virginia Woolf, it took me a while to work out that the things that they did that I really admired, like Thomas Hardy in particular, writes about landscape in just sort of a breathtaking way. And his ability to notice things. I think W.H. Auden said that Hardy had a sort of hawk vision, that he was able to tune in on tiny parts of the landscape and just sort of write about them in these miraculous ways. And I started to see that there was a connection between that kind of literature, the kind of literature that forced us to look again at the world around us that we were missing, and running, which is something that forces me to, you know, zone out of what it is that I've become obsessed with on any given day, and it gets me outside to look at things. I think it was the third novel that Hardy wrote, but it was the second one that he published, but it was the first one that anybody took any notice of, was a novel called Under the Greenwood Tree. And the first line of it is like a slap in the face to an urban readership who had forgotten so much of what it's like to be in natural environments. And I can't remember the exact first line, but it's along the lines of, to every person that lives around forests, to every tree dweller knows that every tree has its own voice as well as its physical appearance. And just the sort of exotic uniqueness that someone who lives around trees could know them so well that they know what they sound like. These are the sorts of things that we forget by living urban lives, I think, that there is a kind of life and character to natural environments that is often beyond our immediate comprehension. And I think literature is very, very good at just pulling back the curtain a little bit and giving us the opportunity to look again at something. And I think running does the same thing for me as well. It allows me to look again at things that I didn't quite see the first time.
That was British author, teacher and runner Fibre Cregan-Reid, whose uncle won marathon gold at the European Championships in Budapest in 1966. Footnotes: How Running Makes Us Human is published by Ebury and retails for in around €10 in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the insightful words of German philosopher and writer Martin Heidegger, who Weber quotes at the start of the book. We do not have a body, rather we are bodily. How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.